you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
OAR called This Town. This was the theme for the College World Series a few years ago. The College Series was awesome. I think it was the year Fresno State won. But ESPN, you can't even find it. ESPN put this awesome, like, collage together with this song in the background. And the video was great. College World Series, the lieutenant, one of his favorite, Patrick, one of his favorite events. Yeah, I liked it in the old stadium. I don't know that he's been to the new one. So. All right, a couple emails. One's about Koreans. Team Spirit, 1989. We set up our radar site at Chilpo Beach, just outside of Pohang. The Rock Army had some 20 millimeter Vulcan set up on the beach, while two Rock soldiers manned the gun and shot at a towed target. The remainder of each platoon was kneeling, sitting back on their heels with the palm, with their palms flat on their thighs as some in some freaky position of kneeling attention. After the target made a few passes, the Rock in charge would scream something and two new soldiers would leap to their feet, running towards the guns while the two shooters ran to assume the position in the formation. This went on all afternoon. I recall being very impressed by their bearing. My dad trained with some Rock Marines in 1962 and said they were hard as nails. Yeah, let me tell you, the Koreans, I mean, they went to sleep. they went to sleep on that mountain pretty quick. But let me tell you, it was rough. That was not a pretty, that was not an easy life in the Rock Marine Corps. At least the part I saw, man. And that baseball bat story, that's no shit, too. That is no shit. Like I said, we got around that corner, column of twos, right? Right face, forward march, round step march. As soon as we got away from that company, then the conversation started. Holy shit, man. And then it was like, hey, man, he deserved it. He goes, 23 times? Oh, are you kidding me? So then that was a discussion on a hike back to Moochuk. Yeah. So pretty interesting. Here's another one. Mac, I had the same experience a few years ago hooking back up with Marines that I served with a long time ago. It's awesome. The funny thing that you hear is how over the year people's perspectives change on different events. And sitting down together and putting notes together, looking at pictures, is pretty funny. If this was the first platoon you ever had, holy shit, they must have some interesting pictures and stories. Yeah, come on, I was looking like a badass when I was a second lieutenant. Are you kidding me? Yeah. The And then Echo and Ramadi with Scott Husing. Scott's coming on the program here in a couple weeks. I just talked to him yesterday. He's out, been promoting his book, and so his book's out, Echo and Ramadi. He's, I think he was on Fox News. Oh, what the hell? So yeah, he'll be on the program here, and we'll talk about his book. The more I think about it, the more I want to write a book, and it's that book, Things I'd Like My Sons to Know Before They Go to War, or my daughters. I'll put that in parentheses below, or my daughters, but my daughters aren't Marines. That way everybody knows I'm not being sexist, but it's a personal thing for me. What would I like my two sons to know before they go to war? And I mean, then you could, and you'd publish multiple volumes of it, you know, maybe 10 lessons from different people, things you're going to encounter, things you need to be mentally prepared for. So I want to write that and get it published the more I think about it. Yeah, come on, I need to be an author. I've written stuff for publication in magazine, the Gazette, and newspapers and things like that. But, yeah, so I write this thing about my prediction on the transgender policy. So I call up Napa Man yesterday, right? And I said, hey, I want you to listen to this prediction on transgender. And so I read it to him. And at the end of it, he goes, wow. And I said, yeah, what'd you think? He said, who wrote it? I said, I did, you dumbass. And he goes, whoa, what? I'm like, really? You didn't think I could write like that? He starts laughing. He goes, well, I didn't. I'm like, all right, this conversation's over, ass clown. Yeah, he had that coming to him. Okay, let me get it teed up. Combat concepts. About the last 30 minutes of part. The last part. And then, like I said, there's a Q&A. You can listen to the Q&A on your own. Okay? I'm not going to bore you with that. Okay, so let me get this set up. It's got to be at 33 minutes and 3 seconds. That's right. And then we'll be ready to go. All right. I just went too far. 32:25. Okay, so we're going to join General Zinni in stride. This is where we left off. It's the last 30 minutes on, like I said, the best PME I ever sat through. And again, he's given his combat concepts speech. So sit back and relax and enjoy the wit, wisdom, and the knowledge of Colonel Anthony Zinni. Just had given up 9th Marines in 1989, was in Quantico, and came over to the basic school to give this presentation. This is about 2 hours and 30 minutes into the presentation.
We designate a reserve. I don't like the term reserve since we're into changing terms. Reserve is like in cooking. Reserve 2 egg yolks, you know, holding back. The term reserve implies holding it back. I don't like it. I don't like the idea of big reserves. I think that's bullshit. That violates everything we've heard today. I rarely use a reserve. My reserves are deployed laterally, not vertically. I want you to think about that. The guy thinks I got a reserve, because you're goddamn American, you have a reserve somewhere. I really don't, you little sucker. It's deployed laterally. So if I see 4 battalions, I really got 5. No, I got 4. You hit 2, the other 2 will become the reserve. And they'll come at you laterally, not vertically, you know? Think about that for a while. I don't decide on the reserve. Now the missions for the reserve. I want you to take all the missions that we write about. They all reinforce failure. If you assign a reserve for rear area security, that reinforces failure. What fails? The rear area security. If you assign a reserve to be prepared to carry out the mission of one of your maneuver elements, What failed? That maneuver element accomplishing his mission. That's a failure mission. You know? You have to have an anticipated use of this reserve. You have to see it. I got a question for you. The reserve, the force of opportunity, so valuable, the key, the thing that drives it home. When it's committed, is it the main effort? Should it only be committed as part of the main effort? If you commit it to less, what's the point? Think about that. Every time the reserve is committed, should it be the main effort? Should it be part of the main effort? Should it be part of springing the main effort home? If not, you've got to think about what the hell you're doing with that reserve and why you have it. Think about committing the reserve first. I don't buy this bullshit that he who commits the reserve last wins. I like first. I make my guys give me examples of when you commit the reserve first. They're pretty good. Spoiling attack. You know, in the defense, attack. I just gave you an example when we were in Germany, where we attacked in the defense. You know, why? Throw it in there. What about if it's an amphibious operation? You got a reserve, helicopter form. You're worried. There's a goddamn enemy reserve running around out there. Like, know where it is. Like, fix it. Like, pin it. If I knew where it was, I'd get it. Once we get ashore, we start moving. You find it too, I'm going to send the reserve right in and fix it. That's the center of gravity. I want to pin it. Well, he comes in the night before the landing and says, we found it. It's here. Commit the reserve tonight. Before 8 hour, 11 hour morning. I got a trigger finger on the reserve, I got to admit. Now that flies in the face of everything I know you guys read about, know I'm a trigger finger with the reserve. It's uncharacteristic of Americans, and I'll tell you what, it screws people up. I also like to create imaginary maneuver elements. I had a fake maneuver element, the force on force. Took some tanks and Amtraks, some engineers and shit, and created a pretend battalion. You know, and these things are great running around. But people try to count. See, they ITV it. You know, they count your maneuver elements. That's got to be a maneuver element. It's running around on its own, it's up here, and you can fake them out. I think we need to be a little bit more imaginative with this idea of the reserve and how it's used and where it's employed. And I don't think we should think vertically about reserves. We need to think laterally. Risk. We talk a lot about risk. And we say we've got to take risks. But one thing we fail to talk about is how do you judge the degree of risk you're taking? That's something to teach the officers here at Quantico. This is risky. You know what my question is? How risky? Am I going to lose the whole enchilada? Or is there a danger that I'm going to get my ass kicked and have to give up 3 clicks? What is the risk? We don't teach people to measure the degree of risk. Rommel, I read somewhere, measured the degree of risk. If I do this, I can lose the whole campaign. If I do that, I might lose the force. If I do this, I might lose the ballot. You know, but measure the risk you're taking. You're more confident in taking the risk if you sort of have a little feel, a little instinct about exactly what you're risking in the worst case.
I like that. I like that, and the way he talks about it when, you know, first of all, who's got a reserve? At what level do you begin to have a reserve? Everybody can have a reserve. So, you know, this whole intellectual rigor that devotes to the reserve. Again, if you're a regimental commander, if you're a battalion commander, if you're a company commander, and you don't sit down and do this, shame on you. You have to tell your guys how you see the battlefield, how you see this. It promotes great education. It promotes great interchange. It gives them a reason to read, to understand these concepts that we talk about. This is great shit.
Measuring risk is going to lead and determine the degree to a better acceptance. The last point, and you never thought we'd get there, I want to talk about, is something called battlefield adjustment. The mark of a truly great military force is the ability to adjust on the battlefield. To tactics that are now required that you didn't anticipate, to new techniques, to weapons. Examples. I read Iwo Jima, go back to that. Right before Iwo Jima, after Tarawa and Peleliu, the Marines said our organization is screwed up. So right in between battles, they reorganized the Marine Rifle Platoon. Two squads as we know them now, with fire teams as we kind of know them now, except there were 3 men instead of 4 men, but they formed a 4-squad. This squad was composed of 2 demo teams, 2 flamethrowers, and 2 BARs. The BARs covered and suppressed, flames went up, you know, burned everybody, pushed them back, and then they blew them up. The old blind and burn and blasted kind of concept. That was an innovation for the islands that had caves and bunkers and adjustments. Rommel with his 88, a battlefield adjustment using a weapon system as it wasn't anticipated. The techniques, corkscrew tactics in the Battle of Okinawa. I love it. You know why I love this one? Because the tankers go crazy. You know, the tankers are, I want to be a maneuver element. They took one tank, one engineer squad, one infantry squad, formed it into a team, and the infantry corporal commanded the tank. I love it. First thing we ever did was get rid of the infantry foam from the tank. That's the worst thing we ever did. I'm telling you, tank infantry tactics are not dead. We parked our tanks in Vietnam. Read how the Australians used their tanks in Vietnam. I will recommend a book to all you in basic school called In Good Company. It was written by an Australian who was a platoon commander in Vietnam. He's now a lieutenant colonel. It's the greatest book I've ever read about small unit tactics operations, small unit leadership, small unit leaders thinking. It's phenomenal. And they talk about how they used armor in the jungle. You know, and the basic value of tank infantry tactics. We shit canned it. When I was a captain, we did it. You know, we cooperated with tanks. Now I can't. I get whisked along in the back of this ATC, you know? And let me tell you how tankers do it. You made all these tankers maneuver element commanders, and they want to have it, they turn to the infantry guy and say, as soon as you dismount, you're on your own, Jack. You know, you got it. I'm over here. You're there. You know, if you think there's cooperation, it's a 29 bombs mentality. Yeah, we got to be careful with all that. There's the use of armor in the Philippines. I really saw it the time I was down there. But it isn't going to be with the kind of mentality he has now. Again, it's this I don't do windows syndrome and the failure to adjust. You got to adjust to the environment and to the enemy. What he gives you and what he does. If you can't make the adjustment, you're doomed. There's going to be many more days on the Somme and the kind of Civil War tactics we have. All right, I'm done. 3 hours instead of two. If you got some questions, comments, I'll be glad to take it. Sir.
Yes, sir. You said you did 10 operations. How many times did you identify a center of gravity before each operation, or did you do it every operation?
Every operation. My guys made me do it. And sometimes, I'm going to tell you something, I was stretching. There wasn't enough there to really come up with one that I was confident in. But I had to have one, because you have to have a focus. You have to have something you're aiming at. So it had to change then eventually, or it had to clear up and become more defined. But I had to have something to grasp onto. And I had to have one thing. My guys would try a lot of times say, there really isn't one here, Colonel. And I'd say, no, we're going to make one. We're going to make one. We're going to have a focus. And if it isn't right, it'll get us into the fight, and we'll clear it more, or we'll change it. Sometimes they said, sir, there's a lot of them. There's three of them out there. Let's go after all three. No, going after one. Now we're going to focus on one. But we did. You know, and that led to a lot of interesting discussions. Not all the time was I confident, but a lot of times people were pretty hokey, you know.
That things got started from the highest level and worked its way down.
Well, absolutely, because I don't think you can express intent without having an object for your intent. The object has to be the center of gravity and what you want to have happen to it. You don't like the term center of gravity. If we're going to create a new term, it's going to be critical capability, you know, whatever you want. I don't know, call it again, you know, Buick, Chevy, whatever. It's there. You want it. It's a thing. It's something. It, you know, and I don't mean a physical thing, but there is something to latch this intent onto to anchor it to. Or else, how can you have an intent without an objective? How can you have an objective without an idea of something you're after and you want to disrupt, dislodge, break the cohesion of, destroy, neutralize, suppress, or whatever?
Yep. As far as vulnerabilities, you didn't always, those weren't always obvious when you started.
No.
You could attack without knowing specific vulnerabilities.
That's right. That's right. And you're looking for the vulnerabilities and you're looking for the relevant ones. Again, you know, that's something you got to sense. Relevant to the intent. And of course, gearing you eventually to the center of gravity.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
I'd like to ask on three specific procedures we use and your comments on these and how you use them. That TSNL, the SAP planning sequence, and the IPV you already talked about.
All right. Let's take the first one. I'm a big believer in the estimate of the situation. I think if you master the estimate of the situation, you understand it, you truly can draw, you can truly do an analysis.
The question was estimate of the situation, staff planning process, and IPB, which is intelligent preparation of the battlefield at the time.
analysis of the mission, you can truly understand the enemy, draw the center of gravity, look at the vulnerability, understand the value of terrain, the appreciation, use the environment, all those things. Imaginative, the true essence of the art of commandership, develop combat power, generate it, maximize mobility, all those things you do as a commander in a decision, those are the results of the proper estimate of the situation. The true quality of a commander is the ability to do the estimate. I don't give a shit if it's a squad leader. The kid that all of a sudden is on patrol and bam, bam, two shots, he's down, they execute a contact right, and he's now got to decide, do I break contact, do I go into him, do I call for fire, he's going through an estimate. And you met TSNL Framing, alright? You may not like it because it's a grocery list and it's an acronym. But it's still, you find something better, fine. It'll still have the same components to it. It's automatic. Let's go through the staff planning process. The rapid planning process with the new SOC. I fell in love with that. I got my own. It isn't the one they teach at the LFTC because I don't like it. You know, I developed my own and I use it all the time, even in the conventional ops. Because it's fast, it's quick, it gets things done. It relies on a couple of key things. One is integration of staffs, not layered staffs. You know, when you go through, it relies on quick, short briefs. It relies on quick decision points. You know, it's done very quickly, and it shortcuts the system, but still manages to get into critical things and reduces time tremendously. It's an efficient way to do business, and it doesn't leave anything out. Let's talk about time, planning time, which is...
You know, one of the things that you get from this when you listen to it is that, you know, and this is the byproduct of military education and being a lifelong learner and whatnot, and that is he messes with everything. The processes that he sees, he takes them, he tweaks them, he refines them. Most people that aren't lifelong learners, they just plug themselves into the process and they allow the process to do what it does. You know, when you see guys that are that have master's degrees in these things, and they're earned in the field, they're earned by reading, they're earned by discussion, but they have graduate level knowledge, they constantly do that. They tweak everything to conform to reality, to conform to them, to conform to speed. They tweak it all, and he's an incredible example of this, and that's one of the reasons why he was so good at this.
The true crux of the matter here: if I got 12 hours, why not use 12 hours? Why not milk my staff and my subordinate commanders everything they got? Why not bring out every idea? Why not go through every fine detail I can to ensure the operation is going to be a success? Now, if I've got 12 minutes, then I'm just going to say, go. I want to tell you a story. We had a guy stand up here last night who said, the Royal Marines, you know, and the SAS and all this stuff. I had a company when I was in 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. We went to the Caribbean, and I was given to a Royal Marine commander, one of their battalions, for the deployment. And one of their companies came to 1A. Now, this is right after the Vietnam War. All my NCOs were Vietnam vets. You know, we were on this exercise. We landed in Vegas. I was on the HMS Bulwark. We had beer and rum, and this was great. Troops loved it. We boomed ashore. In the middle of this exercise, the CO, the commando, calls me up and tells me, we're going to have a little change of plan here. We want you, instead of doing this, to do that. Got it. Boom, moved out. Next thing I know, his little Wessex comes flying over me, drops in, stops me, comes down, he says, come aside. He says, I've got a question for you. What are you doing? Hey, you told me to change the scheme, go from here to here, I'm gone, you know? Instead of being on the sweep, I'm going to be on the block and moving down here. How can you do this so fast, he said. What do you mean I can do it so fast? I got the radio to call my guys, you're going to do this, this, and that, boom, we're here. No, you've got to go through an orders group first. And we've got to have a glass of lime juice, you know? Hey, one more rum and beer I might consider. Lime juice is great. So, yeah, I want to give you another C story, because I think it's important to go back to SNEAC and stuff today. When I was a company commander in Vietnam first came in, I gave an order to my platoon commanders. They went out and gave an okay order. squad leaders were out there. We were in a landing zone ready to be picked up. We had a lot of time. We're going to be there about an hour, and they had plenty of time to give the order. I went around, and I was listening to these orders. They were terrible. They were rambling, disjointed. I listened to a platoon commander give an order, and the guy playing surface, let's go back and talk about chow and ammo again, how that's going to happen and all this stuff. You know, I finally called the platoon commanders back in. I said, this is the rule. SMEAC, 5-paragraph order. You got deliminated cards, you're going to use them from now on. You got it? All the squad leaders are going to use them. Ah, sir, you know, shit. Use them. Well, now what I started to see is they broke out the card. They didn't write anything. They just went through it in a sequence. I saw platoon guys waiting for admin logistics, knew when he was going to get his little load. Nothing was left out, you know, pyro signals and everything. A good little procedure, quick, efficient, nothing left out, knowing my antennas need to go up. It framed it. It was good. Went. I made all my squad leaders do fire plan sketches when we stopped. Why? Because it forced them now to pay attention to what the hell was around them and out in front of them. First time I asked for fire plan sketch, this one guy came back, and he was an artist. He drew a picture. I mean, not a sketch, he drew this picture. I mean, it's beautiful. I got a strange photo of Vietnam, you know, whatever. Not a clue. These things, these techniques, a lot of them, we have to examine them carefully now, are valuable. They cause efficiency. If they cause a degradation of effectiveness, that's a problem. If they don't reflect reality, that's a problem. They need to be canned. If they are effective and efficient, we need the technique and the procedure and need to put it in. If you become, if you become a victim of that thing and it drives you and it becomes an end to itself, then that's wrong. That's a personality problem. Remember the first thing I classed up here was the commander in common, the personality, the driver, the force. If he isn't that strong a personality and he becomes a victim and subordinates himself to a process or procedure, shame on him. Shit can, you know? We're Marines. Or Ruga. We don't need that shit. Now, your last one. I don't believe in it. I don't like, for the same reasons Bill talked about, I don't believe in templating anything. I don't believe the bad guy is going to give me that. You know, I don't really get into that kind of templating. I mentioned doing it once because they were Americans and they were predicting. But, I would never trust anybody to say, I didn't let my tooth do that.
Now, just remember this. In 1989, the big fight was going to be with the Russians in the Falda Gap in Germany. And when you fought the Russians, the Army had this intelligence preparation of the battlefield. And we used to do it during CACs. The Army did it at Fort Irwin. In fact, they built their Op 4 around it. And that was the rigid Soviet-style tactics of, you know, the advance guard is made up of this, it travels at this rate of speed, it moves this far ahead of the main body, then you're going to see this, it's going to consist of this in this unit, then after that you're going to see this as the main body, blah, 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 blah. And that was the intelligence preparation of the battlefield, time, distance, all calculated, all almost deductive, if you will. And he's talking about how he never bought it like that.
We didn't have to fight the shit, you know? Anything else?
Tom? Yeah, I want to ask you, you
know,
you like that term.
Okay, now this is the father of the OODA loop. This is John Boyd talking to General Zinni.
General Bradley, we had a big debate on that. And how did it come to be because of the excess baggage associated with the project? So it caused me to raise the question, you use center of gravity, what does it mean to you, other than saying it's the center of gravity? Well, in other words, obviously it's related to your opponent and what you're going to do. So what does it mean to you as a commander, say, we're going after that center of gravity?
Okay, you got that? Boyd's asking him, you know, yeah, I understand the definition of center of gravity and this, that, and the other thing, but as a commander, what does the center of gravity mean to you? So here's his response.
It is something that I can, that if I can disrupt it, it will lead to his unraveling, his destruction, the breaking of his cohesion, his defeat.
Okay, then in essence what you're saying, in that sense, then it represents some kind of a critical capability which unravels. Is that correct?
Yeah, by definition it would have to be critical or it wouldn't unravel and lead to his defeat.
Point.
Yeah.
In a sense we're talking about a critical capability.
Yeah.
Am I right? If I'm saying it wrong.
It might not be a capability. It might in fact be a vulnerability. Why not? And it will lead to his destruction and disruption. It's a vulnerability. Let's take the Army of Northern Virginia, if you will. And let's, for the sake of argument, say that maybe their center of gravity was Richmond because they were tied at an umbilical cord that summer. keep threatening Richmond, you force the sucker in front of you, and you can keep fighting and then apply attrition warfare because we're less talented force and beat him. Now, you may argue with the analysis of that. My history may be all screwed up. But was Richmond a capability or was it a vulnerability?
Right.
Why is it? That's another head game. You know?
It's not just a vulnerability, it's a critical vulnerability.
Okay. I don't have any problem with critical. Yeah, by definition.
That's what I'm saying. It's either a critical capability or critical vulnerability or something that right. causes unraveling.
Okay.
Critical something.
Who cares?
Who cares?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, somebody in the audience say that. Who cares? Because what you have is you have Marine officers that are very defensive in terms of defending Colonel Zinni, like he needed anybody to help him defend himself. But those terms were important, right? And Zinni's saying that they're important. I think he's saying that a lot of times we're saying the same thing and then trying to say that we're not. So it's interesting to watch the dynamic in the room here.
I think that's the key word. You got to make sure that it's something critical is going to cause him enormous problems so you can realize his purpose and he cannot.
Right.
You can pull him apart.
Yeah.
And the reason why we've been through this is we've had a huge debate on it for a long time. And one of the reasons why it would cause us to find him is all fucked up. Read it. It's all fucked up. The other point I wanted to bring another point.
It's funny. Boyd's saying that Clausewitz is all fucked up. And Zinni goes to recognize somebody else. This is why he's a funny guy. And as he's going to do it, Boyd starts talking again. And so he takes his hand and then he puts it behind his head like he was scratching his head. And then he's standing up there kind of chuckling.
Unless somebody else had a question here. And I don't want to bring too much of a question. You talked about boundaries, which, of course, I'm obviously very sympathetic to. I think that even when I was operating the Pentagon in the Air Force, you know, boundaries are 14. All I do is I agree with you. And I like the comment that without boundaries, I think this is a key point you made, when you remove boundaries, you force this lateral cooperation so people have to work together. When you put boundaries in, it actually hinders the work.
And the lateral cooperation may lead them to saying, sir, we absolutely need the boundaries. And I would give it to them then.
Yeah, I understand.
But you see, by me not imposing it initially, it leads them to the cooperation which may lead to it, and it can be justified.
See, I think that's the key issue. The fact that without the boundaries, you force a cooperation that otherwise wouldn't be there.
That's right.
See, that's the issue behind it. That's why I love it. Beautiful idea. And the other point you make about phase points and all that kind of stuff, that's another boundary or hindrance and that kind of stuff. Now, you and I had discussed earlier about culminating points. Those culminating points also can be what I call self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, like you've been back to me, you came back to me very hard about fuel, you may only be able to go so far, you should understand that. But in many cases, what people do, they also say, well, we're only going to be able to go so far independent of the fuel, and they come up with something about the troops being tired and all that stuff. You don't know that at that point. And in that case, you can't recognize that until it occurs, or in retrospect. You should at least try to know when it's about to happen. But to try to predict that ahead of time is very difficult.
Yeah, let me go back.
Very
difficult. Well, let me go back to these instincts and this sensing of things. There's an implication of what you say that this guy knows his own culminating point, or he's created, or it's imaginary, or it's self-fulfilling. I'm talking about the commander knowing the culminating point of his subordinate units. I have a feel for it. Let me tell you a little story about the force-on-force exercise. I had a battalion that was in the fight for 48 straight hours. And I don't mean just in the fight. I mean in the thick of it. By their own choosing, chose to fight for 48 straight hours. At the end of 48 hours, I called the battalion commander in. I said, break contact. Go to these coordinates. You're in an assembly area. You're in reserve. It wasn't really in reserve. And go to sleep, because I'm not going to use it. And he said to me, well, I don't want to do that. And I said, that's an order, you're going to do it. And then he turned to me and said, thank you, we needed that. He said, yeah, he did. And he went off, and I put him down in a bag for 12 hours. I know the culminating point, and I know where it is, and I don't ever want him to reach it, even if he doesn't. And so I got to keep tuned to that subordinate unit. Remember I said, I bring my four with me to visit the battalions, not my three. And there's a reason for that. But my context of using culminating point is more entertainment, you know, than it is in an operational or moral or a sense. And a little bit it is, but more in a sustainment.
This is Mike Wiley, and Mike's a Vietnam veteran. He was teaching at Command and Staff during all this, and he's got a very odd way of articulating. The meter of his voice is odd, okay? And he's this really smart guy, and he used to put people off. People used to get put off by this. I mean, talk about stupid, superficial nonsense. And so they would, like, he'd speak, like, Zinni's a Marine, right? He comes out, the way he talks, the way he cusses, the way he articulates stuff. Listen to Wiley. Wiley, every bit as smart and a prime mover in when it wasn't cool to talk about maneuver warfare in the Marine Corps, Mike Wiley was talking about it.
I want to bring here before the evening's over. You know, every time I listen to your pitch, it gets richer and it gets better, and I leave and whenever I hear it, I feel good about the way things are going. And of course, I watched Ninth Marines operate over on Okinawa, and indeed, you know, the stuff that. That Tony's talking about was taking place, and I talked to these lieutenants, nowhere close to their regimental commander. I mean, I lived with some of them in the field, and this drill that they were being put through on the center of gravity was making them think like no lieutenants had thought. And my point is, I don't want me or anyone to get carried away with the euphoria, because this isn't happening throughout the Corps. And you know, if that man from Mars that we've talked about would appear and be here tonight, he'd say, well, the Marine Corps is really ready and rearing to go. However, I went out on Colonel Bliss, and I I've seen a lot of other regiments and battalions, and you know, the lessons, of course, that you picked up, because I've talked to you a lot, I know, I would say most of them come right out of your experience in Vietnam. I mean, they really do, and so do mine. I mean, that's why I get so intense about these things, is because these ideas come out of Vietnam. You know, that boundaries didn't work, and this so much of what we've been taught didn't, yet so much is relevant. What I'm asking, and maybe you've got an idea here.
All right, that's Mike Wiley, and that's.
I don't want to think too much on Colonel.
There's about 5 minutes left in this.
I talked to the mess commander, and he certainly understood, you know, the kinds of things you're saying. And yet, when you went down in the field, you saw business as usual.
And so his lament is that this is not happening on a broad enough basis in the Marine Corps.
And our task is to fix the thing, and I'd just like to hear your idea about where we can go from here so that we have a Marine Corps that's thinking creatively, that is willing to put aside the things that didn't work, because this machine seems to go on no matter what we do. I mean, it stamps out the terrain objectives, and I know that there are fewer. Well, the helicopter flop operations, you know, we talk about and we laugh about it in here, yet I'm convinced unless we change our modus operandi somewhere, so they're going to be going on 6 months from now and a year from now, regardless of all of the words you said. And, you know, what's happening in Ninth Marines now? I know Mike Strickland. Take him out of the picture. I don't want to talk personalities. I mean, Mike Strickland is a great guy. But the thing is, any one of us, you know, can take over a regiment or a battalion and do wonderful things with it, and then we leave, and it comes back to what it was. And I really think that. It's an important question, and I'd like to ask your views on it. How do we get this stuff to spread?
Again, he says all that, right? And then, how can we get this stuff to spread?
Let me make one other point, because it leads into this and it's an important one. I've heard a lot of talk about unit cohesion. I don't agree with the concept of unit cohesion as I see it. Somebody tells me I need to have my battalion, replace that with company squad, together for 5 years, and that's unit cohesion, and we'll be great, we'll go on the battlefield, we'll do well. 2 days after you're in a battlefield, you ain't got cohesion anymore. You know, what happens on the battlefield? What happens on the battlefield is you take casualties. They got to be replaced. Now, you can tell me, well, pull the unit out and replace it. You may not have that luxury. What happens during, what are the dynamics during battle? Guys fleet up, battlefield commissions. Battalion commander was killed, Iwo Jima. 80% of battalion commanders were medevac casualties. They didn't necessarily fleet up the XO. They may have taken the XO from this battalion plus more experience to move them there. So there is a movement. There is a leadership change. During the fight, a new unit comes in. You may want to spread combat experience. We did that in World War II. You may be forced into a political decision to rotate every year in and out of Vietnam, which means you have a continuous flow in and out. As much as you hate it, you're forced to live with it. There is non-battle attrition that goes on. War, every war I've ever studied, is this flow of manpower in and out. Cohesion, true cohesion, is institutional cohesion and not unit cohesion. Unit cohesion will happen if you have institutional cohesion. What does institutional cohesion mean? It means when the corporal checks in that has an MOS and is a rank or a grade and is assigned there for a particular billet, you have an institutional expectation that he has a certain capability. We don't have that now. You know the problem what you're saying now is? A battalion commander can take a battalion and do something fucked up. Because we don't know what he can do. We don't know what he's bought into it. We don't know his capability. We don't know that if he possesses the traits of strong intellect, determination, will, and can apply it, and understanding of all this, the knowledge. So there's no institutional delivery, institutional cohesion, institutional meeting of the expectation of the individual. The first thing you got to do is do that. Make the individual strong, build him up within the institution, live up to the expectation that's presented by his MOS, the grade that he wears, and the fact that manpower sends him to you to assume that assignment. If the institution can deliver on that, no one thing answers that. Not a PME process, you know, not an officer school in 9th Marines, not an application in the field in 4th Marines or whatever. It is a whole institutional-wide ethic or culture that has to be developed and has to be everywhere and has to be demanded on the receiving end and the giving end. We at Quantico are at the giving end. The guys that write orders on people are at the giving end. Out there in the fleet, you're on the receiving end. Expectations on both sides. Demanding of certain standards on both sides. You know, there are a lot of mechanical things you can do. Force-on-force exercises, institutionalizing some sort of PME process within the units that you force people to take part in, forcing the hands of commanders to do certain things. But you can't buy into it piecemeal. You can't say Quantico's doing it, 9th Marines is doing it, you know, Paris Island's doing it, but nobody else is doing it. Or so-and-so's doing it, and the other guys aren't. There's got to be an institutional acceptance, an institutional ethic that forces this to happen across the board. And the focus has to be on the individual. And he's got to live up to the things we give him, the titles. There's a measure that has to be there, very measurable thing that has to happen and be measured. We published the reading lesson. What exactly does that mean to me? Everybody's going to read those books, right? Wrong. Some people are going to read those books, right? All those people that read the books will get something out of it, right? Wrong. Some people will get different degrees of things out of it, right? And what should they get out of it? What should they do with what they get out of it? How do they apply it? I mean, we put something out there, good start. But where is it? Where does that probe go? What is it probing for? Now, I don't know the answer. I mean, I can't create the vision. I mean, the vision is already created by the Commandant. I can't design the implementation. You know, it's got to come from every aspect, every function of the institution. You know, every organization within the institution, it's got to pervade the institution, and I'm not sure how you do that, how you generate that interest. You can be, obviously, an evangelist and run around and scream and yell from the platform and entertain and hope somebody buys into it, or they're anxious to get their box lunch in about a couple hours, you know. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to help. General?
But is that it?
You want to go to sleep? Go to sleep. Go sit here. Go upstairs.
That's General Ben Riper. All right, that is 3 hours of, that's the tail end of Anthony Zinni, Colonel Type, United States Marine Corps, doing his combat concepts pitch. There's a Q&A that has more of this, and it talks about the reserve and the ace as a reserve element. I'm not going to play that today. So that does it. 53 minutes over. That might be a world's record. So we'll get out of here. On a Wednesday. My thanks to the gunner for calling in. Yeah, he was sending me text messages listening to my story about Korea. So my thanks to him for coming on. Watch for the transgender policy. And I think, honestly, when you look at the kind of guy that General Mattis is, he takes great pride in the intellectual rigor he devotes to different subjects, and crafting a position that's grounded, one, in principle, two, that withstands the rigors of, in his case, the reality that the Department of Defense faces around the world. And so, whether the White House accepts the recommendations or not, will be up to the president. But I think that when you look at the issue of transgender, and it's a much larger population than the segment that is looking to be for a surgical remedy, there's people that identify themselves as transgender who don't identify with the gender that they've been assigned at birth. So to the extent, again, that you can deploy and you can militarily pass the physical and the mental evaluations, then you ought to be able to serve. However, if in your enlistment you indicate that you either intend to seek, that you tend to seek a surgical remedy while you're on active duty, that's incompatible with military service because of the psychological testing, the physical stuff that you have to do, you know, the hormone replacement, all that stuff is delicate stuff, and it makes you non-deployable. So I don't know that anybody gives a crap. When you're post all of that, and if you still want to join the military, then as long as you pass, then come on in, the water's warm. So, on a Wednesday, that's my prediction anyway. We'll see what he ultimately does. So, have a great afternoon. We'll see you tomorrow morning when this program reconvenes. You can find part four, the question and answer part, if you'd like to finish off the rest of that Zinni PME. You can find that on the website. Just go ahead in the search box, put Zinni's name in there, click on part four, and you will pick up right where we left off. So, with all that said, on a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.